We're totally thrilled and honored to have with us the Reverend Lamorato Owens, who is certainly one of the emerging stars on the field of Buddhist teachers in the contemporary world. He's an author, an activist, and co-founder of Bhumi Sparsha, a Buddhist tantric practice community, as well as a visiting teacher with several Buddhist centers, including the Natural Dharma Fellowship and the Brooklyn Zen Center. He graduated from Harvard Divinity School and has been a guest faculty member at the Harvard School of Ed on their program on mindfulness for educators. He's also a regular guest on SiriusXM's Urban View, hosted by Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Karen Hunter. And of course, he's the author of The Radical Dharma, which taking Race, Love, and Liberation, Talking Live, Race, Love, and Liberation, and his current book, Love and Rage, The Path of Anger. Anger is a Path of Liberation. What's the subtitle? We have to unmute Lamorad. And we'll be reading Lamorad's book in little installments through the fall. So that way we'll try to have a way to continue to savor his wisdom as we travel the rest of our fall. So thank you so much for joining us, Lamorad.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for having me back. I feel like I was just here. Wasn't I just here in June or July?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's a blur.
Yes, actually at the start of the pandemic, Lamorad.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is pretty much a new cohort of mm-hmm. students.
Yeah.
And this is our compassion year. So the mandala is a little different, but
yeah.
We're happy to have you back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, awesome. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for being here and for joining us this evening. I don't know if you had a choice or not, but if you had to be here, I hope it's going to be enjoyable for you. And I hope everything is going well in the course, and you're learning something, which is always really good. I've heard you had some incredible teachers. Tonight I just want to talk a little bit about compassion. Compassion is going to be kind of more of the material that I'm working on for my next book. If you've read Love and Rage, we actually took a lot of the compassion material out of Love and Rage, and we wanted to really focus it on love as well. So I'm excited. So a lot of stuff that I'm doing right now, this will end up in the next book, which is really my process. As I'm writing another book, I just start teaching the material and then, processing it in a way to get it ready for book form. But yeah, I think compassion is one of the most important things and practices that we can be embracing right now. And it's also one of the hardest things for us to be working on right now, because it's so easy for us to shut down, to kind of contract. It's so easy just to be out in the world and to try to protect ourselves, with a kind of, erecting of walls and barriers. And the ways in which we energetically, particularly in the heart center and the heart chakra, the ways in which we energetically kind of shut the empathic part of our bodies off, or the part of our energetic bodies that deeply sense, deeply experience and feel, how we can just kind of shut that down because there's so much happening right now. It's actually quite overwhelming. And when we feel overwhelmed, it's really, for me in my practice, that's a sign of being super distracted. It's kind of overwhelm. It's like, when you're sitting in meditation and you're trying to pay attention to everything, it's like when we're trying to do open awareness practice, but you can't because you just want to focus on everything. You actually just want to do mindfulness instead of open awareness, but we're trying to like focus on every single thing right now. that's coming up, that's arising, instead of actually cultivating an openness, an expansion that holds everything, you know, that's coming. You know, if we can hold everything, then we're not so distracted, right? That holding is actually a way for us to practice a profound kind of agency right now, where when I have space, then I actually get a choice to focus my attention within the spaciousness. You know, but that spaciousness is also where my joy and happiness and contentment arises from, right? You know, because that space is holding the difficulty, is holding the struggle, is holding the pain, the woundedness, the suffering, the sorrow, the brokenheartedness, you know? And if there's no space to hold these things, we end up contracting around these things. And those difficult situations actually become the totality of what we experience, you know? So when we're shut down and contracted, when the heart centers close, you know, and no space, we end up saying things like, you know what, I'm pissed, I'm tired, I'm sad, I'm overwhelmed, right? You know, and the issue is, I am, right? When we shut down and have no space, then we actually, there's no room for us to differentiate the thing itself from the sense of self, you know? So I essentially begin to self-identify with the thing itself, so I become, you know, because I don't have a choice. There's no space to do anything else, so I have to become the anger. I have to become the burnout. I have to become the rage, you know? And what we're trying to cultivate again is this expression of spaciousness. So I can do more than just be, I can experience in space. You know, I can have the experience of anger. I can have the experience of sorrow, and it's not the totality of my experience. It's not the totality. And you know, contraction is really the root of violence, actually. You know, contraction means rigidity. Contraction means being stuck and being set. Contraction means there's no movement, right? You know, and when there's no movement, there's no space, nothing but tension arises from that, you know. You know, so you can directly apply that analysis, that understanding, to systems of violence, right? And I think initially about patriarchy. Patriarchy is, on one hand, I mean, there are many ways to think about this, but on one hand, patriarchy is the system that actually forces us into rigidity, you know? And when we try to overcome that rigidity by getting fluid, then we're punished, right? You know? And part of that rigidity is the ways in which the system labels us and tells us that this label is where we're going to stay. And if we don't stay there, then we're going to get our asses kicked, you know? Because these labels oversimplify us, and oversimplification, yet again, is another act of violence. You know, oversimplification is also this act of, you know, it's the opposite of fluidity, right? It's that oversimplification is really just an expression, you know, of being rigid, because you don't really get a lot of choice in simplicity. It's either this or that, you know, and which is how systems like patriarchy function. It's either this or that, you know. It's nothing in between, and it's certainly nothing outside, you know. And that's really a hard way to live. It's a hard way to be, you know. But that's really how many of us are living our lives right now. We're living our lives within this experience of deep rigidity, you know. And also, I think this rigidity is reinforced by fear. You know, I don't want to take on the responsibility of being fluid. You know, because if I do that, then I have to start negotiating the complexity. And quite honestly, in a way, simplicity is really comfortable. You know, even though it breeds violence. You know, I think right now we're living through a time that a lot is happening. You know, I call this period a time of the apocalypse, you know, and I talk about the apocalypse in Love and Rage, because for me, I realized the apocalypse was happening years ago, you know. And for me, the apocalypse means unveiling of truth-telling, you know. And really, you know, the apocalypse is really the ways in which the truth is being told and the ways in which we're struggling to be in relationship to that truth, you know. But it's also the ways in which we're being reminded that things have always been fluid and moving and shifting, and we're being reminded of that. We're being reminded that we've pretended to build our houses on sand, or we've pretended to build our houses on rock, but it's actually been sand, and so everything's beginning to slide. And you're like, this isn't supposed to happen. And then you have to realize, but it's always been sand. The system, for instance, that I've invested a lot of agency in, that's always been kind of unstable. You know? This has always been, as the Tibetans say, and as we say into the Tibetan language, this has always been a situation of jikten. You know? And so in Tibetan, jikten is actually the word for the world in Tibetan. And jikten actually means, a direct translation would be destructible foundation, you know, a foundation that can be destroyed. You know, so their word for the world is impermanence, right? You know, but we have forgotten that. So we've tried to get really rigid and set, you know, and we've tried to convince ourselves that everything's permanent and it won't change. But instead, the truth of phenomenal reality and the essence of reality itself is perpetual shifting, perpetual change. That the nature of everything is essentially empty, without form. You know? And this is really incredible to this is something that's really important for us to come into relationship right now, because you know, we are being reminded, you know, about something that really many of us have forgotten, and because we've forgotten it, we've found ourselves in an incredible amount of trauma now that we're being faced with having to deal with, you know. So we've let ourselves get rigid and buy into the illusion of rigidity. You know, and now we're trying to get fluid again, but some of us don't know how to do that. We don't know who we are if it's not this or that. So what happens when this and that gets completely wiped away and we're told, okay, who are you now? With no reference point, with no systems, with no policing. Like, with no hierarchies. You know, who am I if the system of capitalism completely disrupts? You know, how can I prove that I'm successful when I have a lot of money and lots of property? You know, who am I if I can't be a woman or a man? You know, who am I if I can't be white? You know? Like, who am I now? You know? And this is the danger of all of this practice. This is the risk, is that in actuality, the rug is always being pulled from under us. But we've created a sophisticated system of completely, like, ignoring that. And now we can't ignore it anymore. And as one of my dear friends used to say, you know, now our shit is fucked up. You know, our shit's fucked. And that's still one of my favorite phrases to say all the time. You know, not only is your stuff shit, that shit is fucked up. That's a lot. That's a lot to hold, in our practice. But every day I get up now, I'm like, this is it. This is what that saying is really pointing me to. It's like, oh, like I'm living in shit and it's fucked, you know, right? And then it seems impossible. Absolutely, it seems impossible. What are we gonna do? you know, and I can be really hopeless, as many of us are right now. We can feel really hopeless. We can find ourselves in a lot of despair. And that's important to notice that. You know. Or I can begin to do this really hard work of really opening to the reality of everything that's happening. And in doing so, I am entering into a kind of co-creative process. I'm actually beginning to create the future that I most want to see. But in order to do that, I have to be really uncomfortable. Matter of fact, I want, maybe for some of us for the first time, I want to actually choose to be uncomfortable instead of being victimized and terrified by discomfort. You know, how do I do that? You know, how do I choose discomfort? You know, some of you, of course, are saying, you know, I'm always uncomfortable. I've gone through this and this, and I've survived that. You know, absolutely. But I wonder if you've been able to actually choose the discomfort. And, I mean, we're going to go through it anyway. Why not choose it? Why not shift our intention and our, not just our attention, but also our intention, and say, you know what, you're coming, you're here, and I want to welcome you and say, okay, here you are. You know, I'm going to be miserable, absolutely, you know, but I can actually cut through a layer of suffering by actually welcoming the discomfort. You know, I add a layer of suffering on top of suffering when I actually am resisting the basic suffering to begin with. You know? So when I choose discomfort, I'm saying, you know what? I'm allowing you to be here. I'm accepting it, actually. I am accepting. For me, acceptance is an expression of love. You know? And accepting doesn't mean condoning. It doesn't mean celebrating. It doesn't mean I'm throwing a parade for all the discomfort. It means that I am acknowledging that you're here, that this is happening. You know, I am acknowledging and saying, you know what? Yes, my shit is fucked up. You know? And now let's take this step to actually be in a relationship to it and begin to transform it and do something with it. Because at no point am I saying that you can't do anything with it. Like, I'm not saying that you just be a victim and just let things happen to you. I'm saying that in order to really begin the work of transformation, you have to actually genuinely accept the thing that you want to start transforming first. You have to, in a way, you have to put your hands on it in order to start shaping it. I can't change anything that I'm afraid of touching. You know? I can't walk until I touch the ground, right? I can't make anything until I touch it. You know? And we're afraid to touch it because between us and touching the thing itself, and that thing itself can be something really intense, you know, like racism, white supremacy, something like that. Before I can actually touch the thing itself, I have to first move through my brokenheartedness around that thing. You know, and often we can't even see the thing because we're being distracted by this aversion, this brokenheartedness, this lack of being with the deep disappointment that this thing actually exists. You know? So many of us can't even get to the thing because we can't even touch into our deep disappointment that we have to do the touching to begin with. You know? And that's where we're stuck right now in the world. We have a mountain of brokenheartedness that manifests as trauma, woundedness, hurt, violence, all kinds of stuff that we're not touching, we're not being in relationship with and to. And that heartbreak doesn't just disappear, it doesn't go away, right? You know, and it becomes a part of this thing that we're habitually avoiding. And that habitual avoidance also turns into deeper experiences of suffering, and it also turns into acts of violence against ourselves and against others. What I see in the world is not just a bunch of people who are pissed off. I mean, absolutely, it's a bunch of people who are pissed off. Like, you know, many of us are pissed off, absolutely. But what I see actually is a tremendous amount of people who are deeply hurt. You know, whose hearts are so deeply broken that we have absolutely no way or no methodology to really get into touching that brokenheartedness and to metabolizing it, to experiencing it. Because it's the experience that allows us to move through it to get to touching the thing itself, right? I had to let my heart break in order to begin to touch into the reality of racism, you know, systematic racism. I had to move through my deep unwillingness to acknowledge that, like, this shit isn't fair. You know, it's not fair. You know, I had to wrestle with that for a while. You know, it's not fair that I have to be black in a racist country, which will arguably be racist for the rest of my life. You know, like, it's not fair, you know. And so I had spent many years really just not even dealing with it. You know, it's not fair, so I'm not going to deal with it. It's not mine to deal with it. When I came into Dharma practice through the door of meditation, I, you know, was told that the only way that I could ever achieve liberation was to move into the brokenheartedness, was actually to move into everything that I was running away from. You know, and, you know, people, you know, come to me now, and they're like, oh, like, Rod, you know, you're like, people call me like a, what is it that young people are saying now? Oh, I'm like an influencer now, right? Like, I'm an influencer, you know, particularly around racial justice. Like, I'm a thought leader now, you know, and I get asked by a bunch of publications to offer my opinion on race, you know. And for me, race isn't anything that, like, I have overly studied. Like, I don't have a degree in anything related to racism. My first level of expertise came from being black, but that doesn't necessarily mean I had, like, a precise critique, you know, of racism. But I think what makes my view so interesting and unique is that I've done this really interesting work of moving through the brokenheartedness. And so I've gotten really close. I've gotten to touch the actuality of racism, you know, and I see it really clearly now, you know. Like, I can see it functioning because I'm not being distracted by my aversion to it. I'm not being distracted by my trauma. I'm not being distracted by my brokenheartedness. I'm seeing the thing as it is. And it's not actually personal. You know, on the other side of my broken heart, trying to look at the system of racism, it seems very personal. It's about me and me being impacted somehow and silenced and repressed and being restricted from resources. But when I got closer to it, I was like, oh, this isn't even about me. You know, like, systematic racism wasn't created to make Rod's life horrible. You know, it wasn't created to particularly attack me. It was created as the system that's really about domination, you know? And I just happened to be the subject of that domination, but it wasn't about me, you know? So I stopped taking it so personally, you know? And of course, when I got into Buddha Dharma, right, it was just like, oh, I'm this Buddha, this enlightened person. And I was like, okay, I can roll with that. That sounds great. You know, and then I moved deeper into study and practice, and I realized, oh, like, you know, I am much more than what a system tells me I am. I actually don't believe that anymore. So that's when I was really like, oh, this isn't about me. You know, it's trying to create me in a way that Buddha Dharma has taught me to start really rejecting. That's not who I am anymore. You know? And that's how all the systems are working. All systems are trying to create us, trying to define us. And what happens is that we buy into it at our detriment, not for our good. Unless the system is telling you that you're brilliant and amazing and that you're enlightened, like Buddhism is telling us, then it's not telling you the truth. You know, it's not telling you the truth. And so there's a level of release, of freedom, of liberation when you get to the point of seeing things as they are actually arising, not viewing things through the lens of our trauma. You know? And for me, I believe that's where the real change really begins. You know, this is where the real liberation starts, is touching into the thing, touching it and beginning to transform it by no longer believing in it. Having that disbelief completely alter everything in your life. But nothing, none of this is possible if we don't have the capacity to experience our woundedness, our brokenheartedness. Nothing happens. Nothing will happen. You know, at what point do we take responsibility for touching into the brokenheartedness as individuals, as well as collectives and communities? You know, America is nothing but one collective experience of trauma and brokenheartedness that has been left untended to, unmetabolized. And we say, how do we get to this point with this kind of government, you know, which every day seems to like do things that we thought no government would ever do, you know, how we somehow elected every mediocre person who ran for office, you know, and we say, like, we get up and we say, how, you know, how is this possible? Because this is an expression of trauma. This is trauma. You know, if you saw the presidential debates last week, it wasn't just that, it was just old white men yelling at each other, but you know, it was just an expression of trauma. It was just trauma stemming from this deep sense of hurt, this deep sense of two men raised in a system where they actually have no idea who they are. You know, and they're performing a version of who they think they are, and it's no longer working anymore. Because the apocalypse is really about authenticity. It's about disrupting everything, including who we're pretending to be. So either we get authentic, you know, or we continue to suffer and drown within this really inauthentic way of being. There's no collective liberation for any of us until there is a collective emphasis on metabolizing and moving through the brokenheartedness and the trauma and the woundedness. Everything's in trauma. We're in trauma. The land's in trauma. Our systems are in trauma. Our institutions are in trauma. Our leaders are in trauma. You know, the air is in trauma. The water is in trauma. You know, trauma is an energy that saturates everything. You know, the land that we're living on and practicing on is still reverberating with that initial violence of genocide. You know, it's still reverberating with that. You know, if you listen closely, you can hear the struggle of the land, the struggle of the earth to be well. You know, you can hear the beings connected to the land who are still themselves bound, you know, in trauma. You know? And then we absorb that. You know, not only do we absorb it from the land, we have traumas passed from generation to generation. You know, we have intergenerational trauma, transhistorical trauma, right? You know, on top of all the daily traumas that we're experiencing just by living, you know, by living and by living in a world and moving through a world that is so hostile to many of us, and the resistance that we have to engage in, how that resistance creates the woundedness, the trauma that begins to impact, you know, how we are in the future, you know, that we get stuck in a cycle that seems functional, but instead is actually binding us to behaviors that are quickly, you know, that quickly become outdated, you know, that no longer meet the moment, but is still trying to meet a moment that happened in the past. I mean, we don't even have a language for this collectively, you know, as a country, you know. So how do we move forward with this? You know, and this is why, you know, I come back to the beginning, which is compassion. You know, again, compassion being the most important practice that we can utilize right now to open the heart, to metabolize trauma, to stay connected, but also to use compassion to hold the brokenheartedness so I can move into it and move through it and touch the thing that I'm trying to touch in order to begin to liberate it. You know? And I can't be afraid of the pain anymore. You know, I have to begin to see the pain as a teacher, as a friend, as a guide, as a guru. Maybe we see the pain as a lover. Who knows? It's different for all of us. You know? I learned to see my pain as both a teacher and also as a friend. Like, this pain, my woundedness, my brokenheartedness is teaching me something really important. You know, it's teaching me really how to stay connected to the world. You know? And to do that, I have to also choose that discomfort. I have to choose to be there. I can't keep running away from everything and thinking that's going to get me free. I have to essentially choose to show up to my brokenheartedness, choose to show up to my trauma. You know, and maybe initially I have no idea what to do beyond just showing up, but showing up is the beginning. Showing up allows me to start slowly taking responsibility for my pain. It doesn't matter if I've been a victim of so much, right? It doesn't matter if I've had to survive all kinds of things, you know, I am still responsible for my healing. Mm-hmm. This is when I evoke Whitney Houston and say, you know what, it's not right, but it's okay. You know, it's not right, it's okay, but it's okay. It means that, like, yeah, it's, I don't think it's right that I have to be a victim of certain forms of violence, you know, and then have to still do my own work of healing, but it's okay because I can embrace the practices, the methodologies to free myself from these experiences, to deeply experience and metabolize them and release that energy. I have the capacity to do that, so it's okay. You know, it's okay. So I wanted to offer a little bit of a practice for us, you know, maybe to help us really start getting into this practice of compassion. In my work, I define compassion as this wish for others to be free from suffering. So that's aspirational compassion, but compassion in action, which is the compassion that I'm more interested in, is not only do I want beings to be free from suffering, I'm actually going to get involved in that freedom struggle, right? For myself and for others, you know? So we start with the aspiration. Yeah, I want everyone to be free. Then we move into the compassion and action, or the fruition of compassion, which is like, okay, and this is what I'm going to do. You know, this is the work that I'm going to engage in to become a benefit, to become an agent, a benefit for others. And of course, that first stage of our compassion work is empathy. I have to tell the truth about how I'm experiencing things and what's going on. You know, I can't bullshit myself and think that, like, you know, I'm going to somehow authentically show up to other people's pain. You know, if I bullshit myself about my pain, I'm going to bullshit you about yours. You know? So the first step is telling the truth. I tell the truth about what I am experiencing. I begin to tell the story and the narrative of my own deep discomfort. You know? And then from that, like, I turn my attention to the world around me, to others, and I say, oh, you know what? I think others are in some kind of discomfort as well, you know? You know, some kind of suffering, maybe along the scale of mine, maybe greater, maybe lesser. And that's really the most important piece, I think, of this developmental stage of compassion, is that I have to link my discomfort to the discomfort of others around us. I have to link my discomfort to everyone's discomfort, actually. You know, and the one part of this that, you know, we really don't like to do is that, like, I even eventually, not maybe at the beginning, but eventually, if I really want to do this shit for real, like, this is graduate school, PhD work level compassion. So if I really want to get to that level, I even have to connect to the pain of the people that I can't fucking stand. You know? So go ahead and pick the person that you can't stand and say, when I get to this person, I'm going to be enlightened. You know? When I start considering the pain of this, fill in whatever word you want to call this person, when I get to that devil, you know, and empathizing with that, then I have gotten somewhere. Give me my certificate. But many of us don't go there. We start really small, you know, and we take our time, you know. But, you know, so we connect and we say, okay, we're similar, right? You know, and then I think there was a point where there's a kind of sympathy that we experience. And sympathy means abiding with. So not only am I touching my discomfort, I'm touching the discomfort of others, I'm just kind of sitting with it, you know, because we can move really quickly through all of this. But when I sit with others, with the discomfort of others, when I sit with my own discomfort, I'm allowing myself to hold space for that. You know, that's like allowing the pot to simmer, you know, to give rise to, like, this really rich, beautiful stew of compassion. I have to really feel the discomfort, not just by it's more than just touching and saying, oh yeah, I'm uncomfortable, they're uncomfortable, okay. You know, I'm done. No, I'm sitting with it. I'm allowing that discomfort in a way to break my heart. You know, I have to know it. Like, I have to understand that discomfort in a way. And then that begins to lead us into this real aspiration to be free from this. Like, what does it mean to get free? Like, what does it mean for myself to get free? What does it mean for me, for Rod, to be free from this deep heartbreak, discomfort, trauma, whatever I'm calling it? What would that be like? What is my dream of freedom? And this is important to understand, is that, like, many of us have actually, we've lost our ability to dream and envision ourselves beyond the hurts. We actually don't know who we are. beyond the hurts. Because we've lost the spaciousness again. We've lost the spaciousness. So I am hurt. I am wounded. I am traumatized. There's no space anymore. There's no space for me to begin to understand that, indeed, this is just an experience within this vast amount of spaciousness. And within the space itself, in and around the thing itself, in and around the brokenheartedness or the trauma, I can experience liberation. And I want to do that. I want to do that for myself. I want to experience liberation for myself. And if other people are like me, and they are, then I'm sure others want to experience that liberation as well. So that opens the door to actual aspirational compassion, which is, I want all of us to be free. Even the ones that I can't fucking stand. So again, you may not be at that high level right now. You know, maybe you're like, you know, there's a separate group for the people you really can't wish compassion for. That's fine. You know, we have to start somewhere, right? You know, but we have to commit to getting there. Like, we just can't say, you know what, I want everyone to be free except for these folks. And that's fine to start, but it's not where we're going to continue to be for the rest of our lives. Our work should always be to want everyone to be free, you know. So the aspirational compassion is, yes, I want all of us to be free, but that doesn't mean you're going to do shit. You know, there are a lot, you know, in the world of Buddhism, there's a lot of people who walk around talking about how they want everyone to be free, and they do stupid shit. You know, I won't name what that stupid shit is, but they do stupid shit that actually is very not in line with compassion. We have to move into the fruition of compassion, or what some of us may call compassion in action. You know, and when I move into compassion in action, or the fruition of compassion, that means I am beginning to enter into a deep discernment about what I am going to do to bring about the liberation of all beings, including myself. What am I going to do? What am I going to get involved in? What are the practices that I'm going to deeply commit to? Again, the practices are important, but we also have to add an action piece to this. I'm going to sit and do my, like, we're going to sit and do this practice soon, but that doesn't mean you've done shit. You know, it means that you've sat and done the practice. But then after that, we are thinking critically about how to move into action. How am I going to start talking to people now? How am I going to start treating myself? You know, how am I going to start setting better boundaries? You know, how am I going to start interrupting violence around me as it happens? You know, how am I going to take responsibility for my communities that I belong to? You know, how am I going to repair, you know, the harm in my life with others? What am I going to do? We're going to do something. And not only are we going to do something, we're going to do something that's going to be probably really uncomfortable, because compassion is helping us to choose the discomfort. You know, that's so much of our work. If, you know, people also ask me all the time what their work is. I talk about the work all the time. And I often say, if it's really easy, it's probably not your work. You know, if you want to get free and it's really easy, it's probably not liberation work. You know? If it's hard, then there's a good sign that's where you need to be. You know, if you're like thinking right now about what your work is, and you're thinking about something, you're like thinking, God, fuck, I don't want to do that. Bingo, that's it. You found it. You know, you found your work. You know, but our aspiration has to be so strong that it like propels us into the fruition of compassion, into compassion and action. You know, and the two things that really guide, that create, I would say, a container for our expression of compassion, or rather, the one thing that guides that expression of compassion is wisdom, is clarity. You know, and when we get wisdom and compassion together, and we bring them together, then we create this intense momentum that drives us into enlightenment, realization. But compassion needs wisdom. Wisdom needs compassion. You know, more of a secular way to put this is that ethical care needs clarity, and clarity needs ethical care. You know, to bring both of these together to create this bird, really, because it's just like two wings of a bird, right? And it just flies us into this kind of profound enlightenment and realization. Again, this is not easy. It doesn't mean that we kind of, it doesn't mean when we get compassion and wisdom together and we start selling, it doesn't mean that everything's just like easy going after that. It's actually, we still continue to work. You know, because compassion and wisdom together will really make us go into some really depressing places. You know, it will inspire us to develop a level of integrity that will seem self-righteous. You know, and that level of integrity means that, like, I am getting really clear about who and what I am and what I will and won't do. I'm getting clear about my boundaries. I'm getting clear about what's healthy for me and what isn't healthy, you know, because I care about myself and I care about the well-being of others. And this is compassion in action in this moment, drawing the line and saying, this is where I'm at, and holding that line. You know, it's going to make you seem super, super self-righteous because we're living through a world where people are really struggling with integrity. Where a lot of people actually don't know who and what they are, you know. They don't have a sense of ethics. They don't have a sense of what practices of compassion or love and so forth are, you know. And they're too afraid to touch into the energy of these practices for themselves. You know, so you show up with your boundaries and with your compassion and with your clarity, and you're gonna seem super self-righteous, but it's not self-righteous. You know? And it's gonna take us into really tough places, you know, it's gonna take us into relationships with people who are gonna resent that. They resent integrity. You know, they resent the clarity. You know, so you have to take responsibility for that. You know, this is part of the practice, this is part of the work. You know, is that the choices that I make to get free will be misread by others around me. It's not right, but it's okay. You know? So, I'm tired of talking now. So, which is ironic to say since I have to lead a practice. But the practice I want to offer you, I think I've offered this before in the past here. I don't quite remember. But I want to, if you're reading the book, I want to give you kind of, I guess, the Seven Homecomings practice. I think I've done that before here, if I'm not mistaken. You know, it's like it's my gimmick right now. You know, Dharma teachers need a gimmick. Everyone you've heard from who's a Dharma teacher has a gimmick. And I promise you they've made a lot of money from that gimmick. I don't make money from my gimmick, but they sound great and interesting. So that's enough for me to be unique. So I want to teach you the Seven Homecomings because I think the Seven Homecomings practice is and has been a foundation for me for years. And this practice really came directly out of the ways in which I was really trying to figure out how to be in the world and really have the support that I needed to be in the world, to move through situations, right? And so this is a very personal thing. Like, this isn't like something that's set in stone. I think you can have as many homecomings as possible. You know, the word homecoming comes out of this idea that, like, when I find my refuge and allow that source of refuge to hold me, it's like coming home. You know, it's like coming home, like the feeling of thinking about your favorite place. You know, it can be like something, a room in your house or your house in general or somewhere you grew up. But what does it feel like going to your favorite place and being in your favorite place, be it outdoors and nature? And that's what the homecomings can feel like. It's like being in your favorite place where you feel really held and taken care of and seen and restored. That's where we want to, that's how we want to feel in the world. Like, we want to, not only, we don't have to go to those places, you know, to feel cared for. We can summon those places, those experiences here with us in this moment and in every moment that we need those experiences to be here. ¶¶